countries, European countries, have been on record as preferring de-escalation and demilitarization, but it takes two to tango, as they say.
Australia, the UK and USA appear determined to proceed with building a Pacific fleet of nuclear-powered submarines in response to the threat these countries fear is posed by China. But in doing this, they have made a provocative statement of intent against Beijing, while damaging their relationship with France, which had expected to win this lucrative multi-billion euro contract to build conventional submarines.
This defence initiative has therefore caused offence on a truly international scale, as theoretical allies engage in a vicious war of words. With disharmony between France, Australia, the USA and the UK, the only country apparently untouched by the fallout is China itself. Once again, we see the irony of the Western obsession with Beijing's power, leading the West to look weak and China to look strong and determined without building a single submarine or firing a single bullet.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Activists say it's not enough to trust Biden's promises to end U.S. support for the war. Congress must compel him. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sarah Lazar Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Congress needs to force Biden to end Yemen war. Stay stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Yemen is in a catastrophic state, says Kothar Abdullah, an organizer with the Yemeni Alliance Committee, adding, I have family there. Every day when I call and talk to them, the reality on the ground is far worse than it is ever portrayed. Abdullah, who is based in New York, is part of a network of grassroots organizers across the country calling on Congress to force an end to U.S. participation in the Saudi-led war, using the same war powers resolution vetoed by former President Donald Trump in 2019. These organizers are asking lawmakers to go head-to-head with the Biden administration, which announced in February it was halting U.S. support for offensive operations, but nearly 6 months later has failed to fully extricate itself from the military intervention. As ongoing Saudi-led airstrikes collide with a worsening COVID-19 crisis, organizers like Abdullah are rallying in the streets and marching to lawmakers' offices, demanding they use their power to stop all U.S. participation in the violence, as well as the Saudi-led naval blockade that is chucking off fuel supplies, spiking food costs, and contributing to power outages at hospitals. Some activists have even gone on hunger strike to demand material relief from what is widely considered the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdullah says it's imperative that a war powers resolution is introduced and passed under a Biden administration. So many lives are at stake here. Organizers are up against an administration that has not been forthcoming about what's doing on the ground. The Biden administration's February announcement was met with much fanfare, but public details on what constitutes offensive operations and what exactly an end to the U.S. role would look like were vague from the outset. The Biden administration has since avoided providing details about what American withdrawal looks like. There are signs that the United States of America remains enmeshed in that war. In June, Ilyas Youssef of the Center for International Policy published a briefing which found that the U.S. has stopped providing some forms of assistance, mid-air refueling of aircraft, intelligence and surveillance used to identify bomb targets and arms transfers for fixed-wing aircraft used to carry out bombings. But other forms of assistance continue. The U.S. continues to provide maintenance and sustainment assistance to the Royal Saudi Air Force, RSAF, notes Youssef, a function that is essential to keeping Saudi aircraft flying. Meanwhile, the United States has not put a stop to other forms of transfers. This could include munitions used by attack helicopters, artillery, and armored vehicles, notes Youssef. The United States is also providing ships and training to the Royal Saudi Naval Force, which is leading the blockade of Yemen, although the role of the United States in enforcing this blockade is unclear. On July 16th, a coordinated day of action saw protests in Boston, New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. calling for a new aggressive effort to end the war. Activists hand-delivered letters to members of Congress who are in positions of power or have historically led on efforts to end the war, among them Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Representative Gregory Meeks, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. These activists say that with Democrats in control of the House, Senate, and the White House, there is no reason this war should continue a moment longer. If Joe Biden and the U.S. Congress wanted to end this war, they could do it today. Paul Shannon, founder of the Raytheon anti-war campaign, said in a press statement. Since Biden made the announcement in February, some members of Congress have spoken out. Later the same month, 41 members of Congress called for transparency on U.S. involvement in the war. In April, 76 members of Congress released a letter calling on the Biden administration to demand an end to the blockade. And in May, 16 members of Congress signed another letter led by Senator Warren calling on the Biden administration to use all tools to end Saudi coalition's blockade of Yemen. But activists say they don't want members of Congress to merely ask. They want them to legislate like they did under President Trump. During Trump's tenure, members of Congress led multiple efforts to invoke the 1973 War Powers Act, passed in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, to force an end to the U.S. role in the Yemen war. The act says that Congress can compel a president to withdraw from a conflict if Congress has not formally declared or authorized the war, which the United States did not in Yemen's case. Shirin Al-Adaimi, a Yemeni-American organizer and a board member of advocacy organization Just Foreign Policy, tells In These Times that U.S. involvement in this war was illegal when it began under the Obama administration, illegal when it continued through Trump's presidency, and illegal now during the Biden's presidency. Democrats should not rely on Biden's promises to end this illegal and inhumane war, she argues. The leaders of the Trump-era War Powers Resolution, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Chris Murphy, and Representative Ro Khanna, have so far declined to take similar action under Biden, but there are indicators the leadership could come from elsewhere. On July 27th, call with the anti-war organization Code Pink, Representative Pramila Jayapal mentioned the possible threat of a Yemen War Powers Resolution in the context of a previous Congressional Progressive Caucus fight to structure the rules at the beginning of the new Congress. If the administration were not to do what we think is necessary to stop the blockade in Yemen, as an example, we would then be able to bring up a privileged War Powers Resolution for a vote, said Jayapal, who is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The remarks followed a classified briefing earlier on July 27th, attended by several members of the CPC and Senator Warren. Among them was Representative Ilhan Omar, who took to Twitter to speak out against the Saudi-led blockade. Activists, some of whom are watching their family and loved ones back in Yemen suffer under harrowing conditions, want lawmakers to take action soon and aggressively. This means mustering the political will to confront a democratic administration. Abdullah argues that the suffering of Yemenis should not only be invoked when it's politically expedient. We can't just be tokenized depending on the political weather at the moment. Hassan Al-Tayeb, lead lobbyist on West Asia Region Policy for Friends Committee on National Legislation, told In These Times that any measure to curb U.S. involvement in Yemen war is a step forward. Congress needs to step in and take legislative action. They have a number of tools they can use to cut off ongoing U.S. complicity, including in a must-pass NDAA appropriations bill and even a new war powers resolution, he said. They should consider all options when trying to end U.S. complicity. Numerous activists told In These Times that of all the tools lawmakers could wield, a war powers resolution would be most impactful by far. The blockade, which seems to be contingent on continued U.S. support, is the biggest driver of the calamity in Yemen, which was the broadest humanitarian crisis prior to COVID, and which has, of course, been exacerbated by the pandemic. David Segal, executive director of the online advocacy organization Demand Progress, tells In These Times. War powers resolution remain the most potent tool for forcing the administration to address this, he adds, because from a procedural vantage, the process of securing a vote floor vote is easier than with the other vehicles, and WPRs can't be filibustered in the Senate. Alademi agrees and says that measures in the NDAA are not sufficient to protect Yemenis from U.S. attacks. If these measures go through, they will likely only last for 1 year. It's also arguably unethical to advocate for measures in an inflated war budget that should be drastically cut, not supported. The WPR, on the other hand, can be invoked any time by any member of Congress, brought to debate without delays, and once it's made into federal law, cannot easily be revoked by subsequent executive powers by this administration and beyond. Given Biden's public statements about ending U.S. support for the war, he will also not likely veto it should it pass through Congress. In the meantime, says Abdullah, the blockade is affecting every other aspect of life. There is a fuel shortage, no fuel for hospitals, lack of access to water. She adds, it's very, very important for a war powers resolution to be introduced and passed under the Biden administration, under a Democratic administration.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions: economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries. Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermine countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions cause difficulty for countries like Iran to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security. The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York. World leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern, including rejecting inhumane sanctions. During his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country.
We ratify our request. Our demand to the United States and the European Union governments lift all the criminal sanctions against the Venezuelan economy, against the Venezuelan society. We say it with the reason and morality that we have, and we say it on behalf of 30 million Venezuelans.
Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions and called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Also, Cuban President Díaz-Canel lashed out at the U.S. administration of Joe Biden for intensifying, quote, the cruelest economic blockade ever imposed against any nation.
The U.S. government has not for 1 minute ceased its attacks on Cuba. But at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The cruelest and most prolonged economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally intensified in the midst of the pandemic.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, the Cuban president said, "The U.S. is extorting sovereign states to act against countries it identifies as adversaries." He said the U.S. presses its allies to build coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments. Western media has failed, or maybe wanted to fail, to inform the public about the consequences and global condemnation of U.S. sanctions. Most U.S. citizens are unaware of the severe harm being done to millions of residents of countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Iran.
It's a primary foreign policy tool that the U.S. government uses in order to weaken and decimate countries that it has disputes with. It should be considered a crime against humanity. The kind of sanctions against a country, against a whole people or a whole nation, should be considered a crime against humanity because the effects are horrible.
Exacerbating the suffering of civilians in different countries during a severe health crisis such as the coronavirus pandemic is morally corrupt and a clear disregard for basic human rights. This is what U.S. sanctions have done. The U.S. may be quick to deny this, but deep down it wants sanctions to provoke the populations to rise against the government in the hopes of regime change in the respective countries, something it has for the most part failed to achieve.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power. And furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression and war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. They said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed, unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against an incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, the Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
I think at this present time, the Saudis are willing to keep this thing going. Even if they can't win, they'll keep it going so as to not be pointed at and said they lost. How long they can do this is, I don't know, but I think that's our present situation.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the U.S. was in charge of administering his country's internal affairs prior to the popular revolution against former Yemeni President Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi, better known as the September 21 revolution. He highlighted that Washington used to conduct Yemen's affairs before the September 21 revolution, and the U.S. embassy in Sana'a had the upper hand over the presidential office. The Ansarullah leader went on to say that the U.S. used al-Qaeda terrorists to create division within Yemen and to advance its hegemonic agenda, stressing that Washington also sought to influence Yemen's educational system in favor of the Israeli regime.
The Saudis and the UAE are influenced by the U.S., as is the U.S. influenced by them. They are dependent often on U.S. weapons, of which they are major purchasers, and that makes us dependent on them. But they are not controlled by Washington.
He added that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are just pawns in the hands of the U.S. and are cows being milked by Washington to serve the Tel Aviv regime's interests. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched the war in Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Hadi's government back to power and crushing Ansarullah.
I don't think that the Saudis can win under present circumstances. And I think the support, whatever they got out of Trump, is probably less now, relatively speaking, under Biden. But there's this other factor, and the factor is that the Saudi government and the head of the Saudi government doesn't want to lose face. Now, you and I might be able to accept losing face under certain circumstances, but they don't believe that they ever want to lose face.
The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases. The Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees, however, have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders, leaving Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has addressed the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly via video conference. It was his first address to the main policy-making organ of the world body since taking office last month. During his speech, Raisi said the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have, quote, failed miserably, and that Washington's hegemonic system lacks credibility. Raisi said Washington is using sanctions as a new way of war against other nations, stressing that the U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic during the coronavirus pandemic are crimes against humanity. This year, two scenes made history. One was on January 6, when U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August, from the capital to Kabul. One clear message was sent to the world. U.S.'s hegemonic systems has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. He describes sanctions as the U.S.'s new way of war with the world countries.
Raisi represents the anti-imperialist current of the Iranian population that is fed up with sanctions. For years, the U.S. has been imposing brutal sanctions that have devastated Iran's economy, killed families, working class families of Iran who are unable to access medicine, infrastructure, because of sanctions. And the goal all along with the U.S. was to impose sanctions, blame it on the policies of the Iranian government, make it seem like the U.S. needs to step in with humanitarian aid and overthrow the democratic government in Iran.
Ebrahim Raisi said sanctions against the Iranian nation started not with Iran's nuclear program, stressing that they predate the Islamic Revolution and go back to the year 1951, when oil nationalization went underway in Iran. The Iranian president also said, despite the fact that the Islamic Republic was keen from the outset to purchase and import COVID-19 vaccines from reliable international sources, it faced inhumane medical sanctions. He also described sanctions on medicine at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic as crimes against humanity.
But sanctions have been extremely crippling on all fronts, and the irony here is that the U.S. claims to be imposing sanctions for the purpose of humanitarianism, for human rights, when in reality, sanctions violate those very same human rights that they claim to be defending. It worsens people's conditions. It puts people further into poverty.
The Iranian president said that Tehran has been adhering to its nuclear commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, while Washington violated the 2015 landmark accord, stressing that the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. The Iranian president underlined that 15 reports released by the International Atomic Energy Agency have attested to the adherence of Iran to its commitments. However, the U.S. has not yet discharged its obligation, which is lifting sanctions. We want nothing more than what is rightfully ours. We demand the implementation of international rules. All parties must stay true to the nuclear deal and the UN resolution in practice.
The goal and intent of those imperialists in Washington, D.C., who wanted to impose sanctions, impose hegemony, their goal was to worsen the conditions in these countries to a point where people would be begging for U.S. interference, to blame that on the policies of those governments. This has actually had the opposite force, where the people of Iran know, the people of Venezuela know, the people of Cuba, Nicaragua, Peru, they know that it's not the policies of their governments that are creating crisis, but it's U.S. sanctions, U.S. hegemony, U.S. imperialism that is at the root of all of these problems.
Raisi said that Iran has no trust in U.S. promises and wants all anti-Tehran sanctions to be removed at once, noting that the Islamic Republic considers the nuclear talks useful only when their ultimate outcome is the lifting of all unilateral sanctions. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump left the JCPOA in 2018 and returned the sanctions that had been lifted against Tehran as part of the agreement. During his address at the UN General Assembly, Biden voiced his intention to rejoin the landmark nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in full, if Tehran does the same. He said the U.S. was working with China, France, Russia, Britain, and Germany to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to the JCPOA. But the U.S. has yet to take palpable measures to prove its commitment to the JCPOA since its 2018 withdrawal from the accord in spite of international criticism.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini's testament. In today's program, we're going to discuss another part of the Imam's testament where he exposes the enemy's plots for forging rift between universities and seminaries. Please stay with us. Seminaries have a long history in Iran, while modern universities are considered new institutions, although the older form of academic education dates back to over 1,000 years in Iran. This is proved by the Jundi Shapur University in Khuzestan province, which dates back to the Sassanid era. The first modern university was founded in Iran in 1934, and by the name of Tehran University. However, seminaries date back to the first Islamic centuries. Seminaries have shouldered the responsibility of educating Iranian teenagers and young people before the entry of university to the country. As a result of Western propaganda, seminaries are considered as a center of religious teaching with no link to rationality and rational education. But with the entry of faithful and devoted students into universities in the 1950s, gradually there emerged congruity and convergence between these two educational institutions. Alongside the formation and reinforcement of the despotic climate in the country and further assistance between university and seminary students, the political ruling system was more and more criticized by both centers. Imam Khomeini's high emphasis on necessity of cooperation between universities and seminaries broke the negative mentality among the members of the two centers and society at large. Furthermore, the presentation of new political and revolutionary ideas by him strengthened his base among academics. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that unity between universities and seminaries would lead to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. After the triumph of the Islamic Revolution too, he considered this cooperation and unity very effective for the growth and bolstering of the Islamic Republic system of government. In view of this, he wrote in his testament, "Among the devilish schemes of the big colonial and imperial powers or exploitative powers that have been implemented for many years and has reached its climax since the era of Reza Khan and pursued by Muhammad Reza I different ways is to isolate the clergy. In the era of Reza Khan, it was pursued through pressure, through suppression, defrocking, imprisonment, exile, disrespect, execution, and so on. And in the era of Muhammad Reza, it was pursued by scheme and other ways, one of which was forging hostility between academic and clergyman, which with propaganda was carried out in this field. Unfortunately, due to the unawareness of both strata about this devilish plot of superpowers, it yielded greatly. On the one hand, from schools to universities, it was tried to appoint the teachers, professors, and university chancellors from among Western educated individuals, and those who were deviated from Islam and belonged to other religions, and the committed faithful were placed in a minority in order to train the effective stratum, which would take the rule in future from childhood to adolescence up to youth in a way that would hate religion in general and Islam in particular, and that they would hate clergymen. And at the same time, these were introduced by Britain and later on by the advocates of capitalism and feudalists and supporters of backwardness and opponents of civilization and sublimity. On the other hand, this wicked propaganda, they would frighten clergymen, promoters and devotees of universities and academics, and would accuse them of not respecting religion, promiscuity, and opposition to the symbols of Islam and religion. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, further wrote in his testament, "The result of those policies is that politicians and statesmen were opposed to religion, Islam and clergymen, and the faithful. Whereas, the masses of people who liked religion and clergymen were opposed to the government and the ruling system and whatever belonged to it. And the deep differences between the government and nation and academic and clergymen opened the way for looters to the extent that all affairs of the country were in their power and all reserves of the nation were poured into their pockets, so that you saw what happened and what was going to happen to this oppressed nation. Now, with the grace of God and the struggle of the nation, from clergymen to academics and to ordinary people, workers, farmers and other strata of society have torn up the chains of captivity and broken the dam of the power of superpowers, and rescued the country from them and their lackeys. My advice to the present and the future generation is that they should not neglect this history, and that the academics and the courageous young people and clergymen and students of Islamic sciences consolidate the bond of friendship as much as possible between the seminaries and the universities. And never be negligent of the plots and schemes and conspiracies of the deceitful enemy. And as soon as they see a person or persons who try with their words or deeds to sow differences between the seminary and the university, to guide and advise them. And if it is not effective, leave him alone and isolate him so that they do not let the conspiracy to take root."
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aids to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to budget shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
"We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid."
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban. The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmad Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan, and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Sabah was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation. Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories, but they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996. To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Yusuf Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Yusuf has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Yusuf. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security. During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth.
Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruba Shabbat, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghani people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban takeover in mid-August suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the U.S. toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the U.S. is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital London, following fuel rationing at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blamed the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there is no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that it is looking at temporary measures to address the issue. British media say the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly, whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, 3 petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and 2 of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. But it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households
will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.